I'd like to call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee to order. And Representative Dill, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from the March 14th meeting?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay, we'll run over to Representative Nordness. Representative Nordness, have you had a chance?
If I approved them, yes.
Yes, I have looked. I approve.
All right, Representative Nordness is moves that we approve the minutes from the March 14th meeting. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Okay, members, the first item on the agenda today is we're going to be doing an informational hearing on House File 1819. Representative Wagenius, do you want to take over? Representative Wagenius is going to tell us about aquaculture.
That I'm going to do. And unfortunately, my very favorite witness could not come because of the snow. So what I have handed out to you is an article that Dennis Anderson did in the Star Tribune. I think this was about a year ago. And I just want to point out what my star witness would have said. He lives on a wetland in Barrett, Minnesota, which is pretty far away, and you have to come through the snow to get from there to here. And he says, we own perhaps 500 feet of shoreline on a shallow lake that is about 25 acres in size. When we moved here, the lake was as clear as an alpine stream and filled with aquatic vegetation. Then in 1998, Sam noticed that there were dead minnows on the shore, and pretty soon he noticed that the water, once clear, had turned cloudy, and today it is so turbid, dirty, that he can barely see his hand through it. The lake's aquatic grasses are gone, as are the bulrushes and other vegetation that once buffered its shoreline. Now the lake supports very few ducks. Instead, beginning in August, hundreds of cormorants descend upon it, hoping to snag dinner. And what's for dinner? Sucker minnows. So that is the article. And I hope you all have an opportunity to read it. Sam is passionate about the water that he lives on. And feels that because he is a riparian owner of this wetland, that when DNR decided to give somebody a license to put fish in it, he should have at least been notified. Actually, what he really feels is that he has riparian rights as a shoreline owner and that his rights were taken away from him. So for you guys here who think about property rights, this is one of your issues. So what I'm going to talk to you about, leaning on this, that I did not bring copies for every one of you, is a PhD dissertation that was done using Minnesota as a study area. And it was studying about what is happening to our ducks. The lesser scop particularly, but why don't we have ducks? I've marked a couple of places in it, and nobody's going to want to read the whole thing, but it is extremely well done, and I do want you all to read it, and I will have a couple of quotes out of it. But what I did, because this is to be informational, I wrote up this blue thing. And so what I want to do is just to quickly go over what I think are issues, the issues in why we don't have ducks. And still you kind of digest the issues. It's hard to say this is what we're going to do. And so this is about digesting the issues, because I do have some ideas of what we should have, what we should do. We start with the top, which that many duck hunters think that 2004 was the worst season in 40 years, and 2005 wasn't much better. And I think there's a consensus on that. And if you'll just look below, you'll see some of the figures about the drop in ducks. In your package, too, I sent out two things, and one of them is the duck breeding population. And if you all want to just get that out, you'll get to see about the duck breeding population. And in the bottom, it says it's the lowest number in 50 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so then people say, what's happening to the ducks? There are a lot of theories out there. I listed them all for you. Basically, fewer wetlands, poor quality wetlands, and not enough upland vegetation. But let's get into some of the facts of what's going on here. In this area of Minnesota, this is another thing that's in your art, is a map of aquaculture ponds in Minnesota. That is places where fish are raised mainly for bait, but fish are raised mainly for bait that is sent outside of Minnesota. Fish are raised in wetlands. Okay. What this is 43,000 acres of wetlands. There are 143 people who have licenses. 73 are just hobby licenses, so very, very few people are covering this 43,000 acres. One of the most important facts that I got out of this is that right now fish occur in 78 to 84% of wetlands in Minnesota. Historically, fish occurred in only 10 to 20%. Of the wetlands in Minnesota. So then let's talk about what's happening in those wetlands when you introduce fish that were not there. Ducks like to eat invertebrates, and the invertebrate densities are now low throughout the upper Midwest. And so when the ducks consume fewer invertebrates, their body condition is poor, and they just don't breed as well. A duck will lose 10 to 15% of its body weight in a day of flight and must recover that weight before flying on. Ducks are currently consuming less nutritious food because the invertebrates that they were eating aren't there anymore. They're being consumed by fish. You'll see that in the second page, the amount of minnows, almost 2 million pounds of minnows for bait were sold outside of the state in 2004. And what that represents is a whole bunch of invertebrates that were picked up out of the bottom of our wetlands and sent outside the state. Nobody's done the number. I have no idea what it is, but you can imagine what has been eaten. Okay. One of the things that you'll hear about are studies that have been done year after year after year, and people saying, how do we solve this problem? And during the course of this, the amount of fish in wetlands, the amount of licenses continues to expand, the amount of wetlands that are devoted to fish continues to expand. But I want to tell you what Minnesota statute says about all of this. And if you look in the underneath the problems with aquaculture, Minnesota statute says a license issued by the commissioner, and that's DNR, is not a determination of private property right. Good for them for putting that in the statute years ago. But it's only based on a determination that the licensee does not have a significant detrimental impact on the public resource. And folks, that's just not true. When you put fish in a wetland, it has significant detrimental impact. I mean, that's, you can see that in study after study after study, and this is just the latest one. actually is a good summary of all the studies that have gone before. One of the things I've heard from people is that DNR doesn't have the staff to go around and check all this out. And let's think about that, folks. It's not the DNR staff that's responsible for saying, getting a license to raise fish in a wetland is not detrimental. That burden is on the person requesting the license. That's law in every aspect, all over the place. If you're going to build a building in downtown St. Paul, St. Paul doesn't make up the plans and then say it's okay. You bring your plans to St. Paul, and they go over them and say, well, this works, this doesn't work. I may give you a permit, I may not give you a permit, you've got to do these things. The burden of proof is always on the licensee. I want to tell you one more fact here, and I'm going to say that the licensees are not meeting their burden of proof. They cannot do it. They haven't been doing it, and that's a problem with the way we're enforcing the statute. But the next thing I want to tell you about what happened to the duck stamp money years ago. And probably not from a lot of you, but people were purchasing duck stamps, federal duck stamps, and the money went to buy easements on wetlands in Minnesota. 50,000 acres of wetlands were purchased. Easements were purchased in Minnesota years and years ago. And the folks at the federal government in Fergus Falls tell me that when they chose those particular wetlands, they were identifying them for what grows good ducks. So it was duck stamp money, what wetlands that grow good ducks, and what has happened is now DNR is permitting fishing, growing fish, aquaculture on some of these wetlands. It's not checking whether these wetlands have easements on them or not. And it says that, well, technically, the easements, those 30 and 40-year-old easements, didn't say you couldn't raise fish in them. That's true. Probably a good technical argument, but the intent of all that duck stamp money was to buy wetlands that would grow ducks. And when DNR is applying our Minnesota statute, which says, based only on a determination that the licensee does not have a significant detrimental impact on the public resource, it has to look at that public resource and say, that was a resource that was chosen and an easement put on it for growing ducks. So I think on that count, DNR needs to look at those wetlands that have easements on them and say, no more. Okay, one whole subject. I'm going to switch subjects now and talk about riparian owners' rights on a wetland.
Yeah.
DNR does not ask for permission, or neither does the licensee ask for permission of all of the owners around the wetland. That's what Sam was complaining about. He had no idea that DNR was giving one person permission because they had some access to the wetland. He had no idea that somebody was going to go fish and ruin his wetland. I think DNR must get permission, because there are riparian rights. And you know where I found out all of this? From the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources talking about law. And it talks about what are riparian rights. Riparian rights are property rights arising from owning shoreland. And then it describes what it means to have riparian rights. And again, for you all who believe in property rights, this is an important document to read. So DNR doesn't ask in this instance, but there are many other instances where it does get permission from riparian owners. And so they're inconsistent in the application of the law with regard to riparian ownership. So there's one other thing I want to point out that I also got in here, is there are duties of a riparian. Now, a riparian will be one of the person who is going to put fish in the wetland, and the duty is they must exercise their rights reasonably so as to not unreasonably interfere with the riparian rights of others. So, just wanted you all to know that on all counts, we can't be doing what we are doing. So I'm just going to raise a couple of other legal issues that I see when I was looking at this issue. And you look on the bottom of your third page here, and it says, PCA has rules that have the force and effect of law that require wetlands to be protected from the kind of flooding that destroys wildlife habitat. One of the things the DNR will tell us is that some of these wetlands are flooded. Guys, they shouldn't be flooded. We have a law that says that when a wetland is used for preserving wildlife habitat and maintaining biological diversity, you can't flood it. You can't ruin that habitat. So I come up with two questions at the very end. These are personal questions for me. And one is, let's try to figure out how much subsidy we are giving a very, very small group of people. I cannot do the math, but I can tell you that if we take a strategy of replacing all of these wetlands and say, well, we need ducks as well as we need to raise the minnows to export outside the state, then we'll have to have 67,000 acres of wetlands, and we'll have to have a lot of upland for the ducks. The cost of this is $3 billion. That gives you some perspective of what it's costing us to allow fish to be raised in our wetlands in western Minnesota. I think there are, when I was talking to folks about this, they brought up a couple of other questions, and nobody wanted to touch the question of pesticides getting into wetlands from tiles, or nitrates getting into wetlands from tiles, but they all said that's got to be studied. And then the other question of why are we not having fish grow in the lakes and reproduce and the lakes where they're going to be fished. So that is just my summary of this. I introduced a bill that, when I introduced it last year, it tightened up the law for DNR. But frankly, after doing the research this year, I don't think the law needs to be changed. I think the law is there. It is strong. It needs to be enforced. And that's what I think we have got to talk about as a community here. Do we want DNR to enforce the law? Do we want to say we want ducks back in Minnesota? We love ducks. We want them back. We want their habitat back because that's the only way they'll come back. With that, I'll answer any questions and chat with you about the issue.
Questions for Representative Weenia. Representative Spalding.
Yes, and I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wiginius, I'm not sure the exact price of the licenses, and maybe there's someone from the DNR here who could answer that question. What these people are paying to conduct fish farming in our wetlands.
Well, I see Ron Pryor here. Representative
Wiginius, Representative Scalzi, we're going to be bringing up Game and Fish Bill after Representative Wiginius is done. We're going to be discussing those issues in the Game and Fish Bill. We'll bring those folks up at that time and talk about those kinds of things.
So will they be addressing, thank you, Mr. Chair, would they be addressing fish farm licenses?
Well, we are going to be talking about that because there is a provision in the Game and Fish Bill to put a moratorium on these licenses. So
right.
That's
and
going to be
I
one
I
of the
understand.
Issues we're going to be discussing.
Right.
Yep. Absolutely. And you can ask that question at that time.
Okay.
Anything further for Representative Wiginius?
I have a question.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wiginius, I appreciate your interest in this, and
One of the things, as you were presenting here, we have over half the licenses held by hobby fish farming. Do you know what that is? I mean, is this just people who are raising fish not for sale, for consumption or feeding their pigs or something?
I believe that the definition is they don't earn any more than $200 from it. So
okay.
It's not a something that it's really like a hobby farm.
Malcolm, thank you.
Anything further? Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Will the next bill then allow those that want to talk from either those that are in the bait business or DNR, will they be,
they'll be able to
addressing
testify,
this issue in the next bill?
They'll be able to testify in the next bill.
Okay, good.
Representative
Norris.
Anything further? Representative Wagenius, anything further?
I have nothing further. Except members, I think we should invite the ducks back into Minnesota. And the way we invite the ducks back into Minnesota is to restore their habitat.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you for your presentation, Representative Wagenius. Representative McNamara, are you ready? Thank you very much. Good job. Representative McNamara moves House File 3116 be recommended to pass, and we're not going to move the bill today, members. There's a number of other issues lingering out there, much like the lands bill. You know, things keep coming in and coming in, so we're going to get started with this, take the testimony from the DNR today, and maybe put in a couple of amendments or vote on a couple of amendments, and hold the bill over today. But we want to get some of this discussion and testimony out of the way today, and we're working on a couple of other amendments and a couple other bills that we'd like to roll into this, and it's kind of a work in progress.
Well,
tired of saying fluid, so work in progress. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we move the bill yet?
Representative McNamara, you have brought the bill before the committee.
Okay. Oh, we're just bringing it forward for discussion.
The bill is before us. We can
lay it over.
Discussion, open to amendments, and then we're going to lay it over.
Okay, because we do have a number of other issues still up in the air. And if it's okay,
that's
with
what
the chair,
I
think I'll take my orange hat off at this point. I'll set it right there. I can still see Representative Cornish quite well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before us is what's commonly called the Game and Fish Bill. A number of things in it, and I think I'll... At that point, you've all got a bunch of amendments, and I think what I'll do is let Ed Boggess from the DNR whip through the bill rather than me stumble around here for 10 minutes.
Good job. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ed Boggess with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and if it would please the committee, I'd just work off of this fact sheet. The first page of the fact sheet lists the 27 sections in the bill as it was introduced, and then starting on the second page, it goes through some background and some rationale for each of the sections. I'll just quickly hit on those, and then we can see which ones there are questions from the committee. The first section would expand the types of donations that can be accepted for critical habitat private sector matching account. Currently, we can accept land or cash. This would just allow us to accept other negotiable contributions that could be liquidated by the department, and the proceeds put into the critical habitat private sector matching account. This is money that matches either appropriated funds or funds that come from the critical habitat license plates, the loon plates, or the deer plates. We have several sections in the bill, and Representative McNamara, I know, has an amendment that moves some of these around that deal with defining some terms in the game and fish laws related to deer and deer hunting. One just defines deer in the game and fish laws to mean mule deer or white-tailed deer, which are two native species. Actually, white-tail is the primary native species, but we do get mule deer, which are native to the western United States. We get a few wandering into the state each year. The purpose of this is just to make it clear that we're not protecting some of the exotic deer that are escaping into the wild in Minnesota, the sika deer, the fallow deer, and other species, where there's currently some question whether you need a license if you're a hunter to take those. third section of the bill clarifies deposit of some receipts in the Game and Fish Fund, and these are receipts from natural resource sales off of wildlife management areas. It's just clarifying some authority. It doesn't change our past practice. It just makes the authority for that past practice clear in law. Just what it basically means is that any natural resource revenues from wildlife lands will go into the Game and Fish Fund. And we actually received an appropriation from the legislature 3 years ago to get some of that money back for working on those WMA lands. The fourth item relates to a federal aid audit issue, something that we haven't done for many years, but there's still provision in statute that would allow use of Game and Fish license receipts for to pay for keeping violators of Game and Fish laws in prison. This was amended in 2003, but the federal auditors are still concerned about it, and I know we've checked with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and they indicated they were okay with this, and it still allows the counties to keep half of the fines. Section 5 clarifies deposits of portions of the deer license revenue. Currently, deer license revenue is dedicated. Portions of it are dedicated into the three different accounts. The oversight committee for these accounts believes that the emergency feeding and servant health management account that was established in the mid-1990s should have been an additional 50 cents from each deer license being dedicated rather than coming from a dollar that was already being dedicated. So this would make statute consistent with their understanding of how that should operate, and this section would have a delayed effective date so that we could deal with appropriation shifts in the next biennial budget cycle. Section 6 relates to adding some authorities for regulating motorized vehicles and watercraft on lakes designated for wildlife management purposes. Currently, the commissioner can post these areas to restrict use of motorized watercraft and recreational vehicles. Our interpretation of that is we can either allow or not allow those motorized vehicles, and we'd like authority to restrict the type of vehicle or the size or the area or season of use. So that's what this bill would clarify. Section 7 is an enforcement provision that just clarifies currently officers can inspect firearms licenses and wild animals in the field, but there are other things used to take wild animals than firearms, bows and arrows, nets, lures. So this just makes it clear they can inspect any type of equipment used to take wild animals that's regulated under the Game and Fish laws. Item 8 specifies the civil penalty for dogs pursuing big game animals. Right now, it's up to $500, and this would just establish it at a specified amount in statute so that we don't have to decide what amount up to $500. Item 9 is a purely technical clarification of some law that was changed last year. Clarifies what we mean by licenses valid in multiple zones. Item 10 is another purely technical provision that just updates some obsolete references to federal law, and I understand this is also in the revisor's bill. Section 11 authorizes the youth firearms deer license to be valid in any of the regular firearm season zones or time periods. This youth license was created, I think it was 3 years ago, as a half-price license. This is to allow the youth to be able to hunt in more and more people are buying all-season licenses, which are valid in any zone or time period, and this will allow the youth license holder to be able to hunt with the parent that has one of those types of licenses. This particular section does have a fiscal impact because we do have a significant number of youth currently buying those more expensive, foregoing the half-price license and buying the more expensive multiple-zone licenses. However, we think that the fiscal impacts of this are an investment in the future of deer hunters and deer hunting. Section 12 is a language clarification, a technical change related to some of the terminology that I talked about earlier. Section 13 amend some language that was passed last year that allows the department to designate special fish management species. We've done that for lake sturgeon. We're now requiring a tag to, if you want to keep and take home a lake sturgeon, you have to tag that fish. Current law only allows that fish to be transported undressed, which means it can be gutted and gilled, but it can't be further dressed. We'd like the authority to allow those fish to be further dressed by a fish packer and be transported. So this would just give the commissioner authority to allow other forms of transportation by rule. Section 14, this defines a variety of terms that have come into use as we've changed the system of deer management to try to get our deer population more under control and make it easier to kill more antlerless deer. And this is part of what's being moved around in another amendment we're going to see, to just get it in the appropriate section of statute where other definitions are. Sections 15 and 16 clarify requirements for parents or guardians accompanying youth that are under age 16 who are hunting with a firearm, and it also makes it a violation for a parent or guardian to knowingly allow a youth to possess a firearm in violation of this section. And we have an amendment in Representative McNamara's amendment that will clean this up a little bit too. Section 17 makes it clear in statute that it's legal to pick up shed antlers, which is a popular activity at this time of the year, and we've told people for many years that it is legal to do that, but there's, if you look at the game and fish laws, it's not perfectly clear that that's legal, so this would make it perfectly clear that it is legal. The second part of this would though also make it clear that it's not legal to use devices that are intended to pull off the antlers before they're ready to drop off, and we have some examples that our enforcement staff have found of deer feeders with various types of entanglement devices designed to catch the antlers and make them fall off prematurely. So this would make doing that illegal. Section 17 modifies the all-season deer license to allow the buck tag. Currently that license comes with two tags, one for an antlerless deer and one for a buck. This would allow the buck tag to be used for a deer of either sex. We're trying to kill more antlerless deer in a lot of areas, and we're also trying to save some bucks in some areas, allow them to get a little older and a little bigger. So this would allow in areas where we're allowing taking multiple deer or antlerless deer without a permit, you can take a deer of either sex with that tag instead of having to use it on a buck. Sections 19 to 22 are various provisions related to fishing contests. We've worked through these with a number of the contest organizers, and many of these things are things that they've requested. It provides an expanded purpose for regulating contests to minimize user conflicts. It moves the time earlier for accepting applications for contests that are planned a year ahead of time. This is at the request of some of the contest organizers who wanted more time, so it allows a month earlier for us to process so that they can know a month sooner if their contest is going to be permitted. It provides a definition in statute for our existing working definition of what constitutes a traditional contest. We've used that definition since traditional contest language was in statute, but it's never been defined. So this would just codify how we've been doing it. Would establish separate criteria for the size of water bodies to have fishing contests on rivers, because those tend to be linear bodies of water that don't have a lot of acreage. So it establishes criteria based on number of miles of river rather than number of acres of water body, with some exceptions where we have large lakes or pools in rivers. And it would clarify DNR's authorities to place restrictions on permit restrictions on releasing fish in contests. Section 23 establishes and clarifies some restrictions and authorities for transporting live fish. The need for this was kind of brought to light by the state record largemouth bass this past fall, where there were some questions of legal transportation and DNR authority to regulate transportation of live fish. So this section would put a general restriction in law that that you can transport a fish alive on the water body where taken, but once you leave that water body, it's illegal to transport it in a quantity of water that's sufficient to keep the fish alive. There would be a number of exceptions to that for obviously aquaculture, commercial fishing, aquarium use, and so forth. It also would give DNR authority to do rules if we've established a state record fish advisory group, that if they come up with a provision for allowing some way of transporting live record fish, we'd have authority to do rules for that. Section 24 just is clarification that the restrictions that require removal of fish houses and dark houses also would apply to other types of shelters that are left on the ice. Section 25 would close the season for spearing fish through the ice the same time as the ice angling season. Ice angling season last session was from the third Sunday in February to the last Sunday in February, but there was an oversight on the spearing fish through ice, which remained at the third Sunday instead of the last Sunday. I know there's a number of separate bills on this issue as well. And then Section 26 establishes a temporary moratorium on the use of new public waters for rearing fish. This would restrict use by license. We would not license bodies of water that haven't been licensed for this purpose in the previous 5 years. And we also, DNR would also not use bodies of water that we have not used in the previous 5 years for our walleye and other fish rearing. And the reason for this, it's relates to the issue that Representative Wagenius just was talking about, where we understand there's impacts of fish and wetlands, and we've established three technical ad hoc work groups of agency and university scientists and specialists to look at the past research on this issue, the past stakeholder work that we've done. We've called together groups of aquaculture, waterfowl, fish managers, wildlife managers, and we've hashed through this issue quite a bit, but we've had difficulty coming to resolution. So we have these technical groups working. We presented updates at the Fisheries, Wildlife, and Ecological Roundtables in St. Cloud in January on the work of those groups. We've asked for final sets of recommendations from those groups by this summer. We've got the chairs of two of those groups here today, but our DNR's intention is to get the products of those work groups. We've asked them to hash through the reams of science and previous stakeholder processes and come up with some preliminary sets of recommendations that we can then discuss with aquaculture, waterfowl, clean water, policymakers such as this group. With the intention by the end of this year of DNR developing a more comprehensive way of looking at the criteria that we use for licensing these wetlands, the pre-licensing assessments that need to be done, the post-licensing monitoring that needs to be done, what all that would cost, who should pay for that, how these licenses should be issued. Right now, there's one license fee for however many wetlands a person wants to license. We're looking at, there was a report done to the legislature in 2003 that said other options could include a per wetland or per acre fee, which might be a more equitable way of licensing. So all of those issues we intend to tackle to the best of our ability during the remainder of this year, and this moratorium would not allow any new wetlands that haven't been used for this purpose to be used until after the end of 2007, which would really mean we'd have an opportunity to come back in the next legislative session and bring in all the experts to talk to this group and others and figure out how we're going to approach this long term. And then finally, the last section would repeal the prohibition on non-residents leaving a fish house unattended. Currently, a non-resident can get a fish house, but they may not leave it unattended, whereas a resident can leave it out for the duration of the winter. So this would treat residents, non-residents, basically the same as residents, except they would have a higher fee. So, Mr. Chairman, that's what's in the bill.
Very
Very good. Representative McNamara, before we go to any questions or anything else, I think we'll do your A2 amendment.
I'd like to move that.
Get that in the shape that you like. Representative McNamara moves the A2 amendment. Get the bill in the shape that he'd like. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative McNamara, can you explain what the amendment does and how it changes the bill?
Most of the amendment, Mr. Chair and members, is technical, and I guess Mr. Bogus could correct me if I'm wrong. The one part that is not technical is from lines, I believe it would be on the second page, line 2.14, unaided visual and vocal contact with the deletion of that. Basically, the language in the bill as it was presented by Mr. Bogus would require a parent or guardian of a 12 or 13-year-old in the case of big game hunting, or in the case of small game hunting under the age of 13, that they maintain both visual and verbal contact with the individual. Well, in the case of grouse or pheasant hunting, for instance, you really would almost be in an unsafe situation. You have to be in the same row as a cornfield. If you were a couple rows apart, you wouldn't be in sight of each other. And so I worked with the agency and came up with an either-or. In the case of deer hunting, you might be just over a small ridge. Might literally be only 20 yards apart, but you and your son or daughter might be just on the other side of the ridge. Under current law, it was accompanied by a parent, and I think subject to a wide range of interpretation by the local CO. I believe the, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Bogus, but was most of the other stuff technical in nature in the A2?
Mr. Bogus. Chairman, Representative McNamara, yes, the rest of this was already in the bill. This is just moving it to different places in the bill. And the only exception to that's on line 2.20, where we missed a cross reference to a statute that we're adding in.
Very good. We've got some other folks too on the list already. We do have a number of amendments, but we'll take questions for Mr. Bogus at this time. Representative Scalzi.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bogus, my question before, and I'm sure you can answer this, is what are the prices for licenses for fish farming? Can you give us, for instance, if somebody decides to get the sucker eggs from the DNR and decides to grow them in a wetland, what would that person pay for that license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, I'm going to ask Roy Johannes from our fisheries to answer that for you, because he knows all those off the top of his head.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Roy Johannes, and I take care of the commercial fish programs for the DNR fisheries.
Mr. Johannes, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. The license for aquatic farming for sales over $200 is $210 per year. If the endorsement for taking minnows is added to that, it's a $310 license. And for the first quart of sucker eggs, it's $400 for purchase from the DNR. After that, it's $6 per quart.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For $400 for the purchase of the sucker eggs, how many do you get for that?
There's approximately 45,000 fertilized eggs per quart times 100, about 4.5 million eggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Bogus or Mr. Johannes. Could you tell us if you think that these license fees go anywhere near covering the cost of doing the studies? I understand you're going to do a big study and you have a moratorium proposed, and we've had studies that have been completed in 2003. They started in 99. So we've studied this issue to death, and we haven't seemed to come to any terms of how really fish farming is, what damage it's doing to the wild, to the wetlands. And we know there's other problems with the wetlands, you know, too much water. We can't control the drain tiling. So we can't control the mild winters. So there's things we can't control, but the things that we can control, for instance, the farming of sucker minnows on our public waters, on our wetlands, do you think, and this would be your opinion, do you think that the cost of the license isn't coming anywhere near covering the studies that will need to be done if it's harming our wetlands.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, I can take a shot at that in terms of sort of the overall studies as far as the actual work that's involved in the licensing and the inspection and review that goes on. Mr. Johannes may have a better answer there, but what we're proposing, what I described earlier that we're proposing to do over the course of the rest of this year that we started last August is not a study per se, but it's asking agency and university people that have been working on this issue to look at the studies that have been done, and because this is a complicated issue, and we're trying to come up with a set of recommendations. And you're right, it's been DNR's been looking internally and then with the external groups for the last roughly 15 years at this issue and how do we manage this issue, and it is a difficult and complicated issue. Those are existing staff that are doing it as part of their job. We do have an ongoing study that's looking at the whole issue of why are some wetlands clear and some wetlands cloudy, and sometimes there's a fish relationship and sometimes there isn't. And that's a major landscape scale study. I can't tell you what it's costing, but it's a very expensive study with a DNR fisheries and a DNR wildlife scientists leading the study and several graduate students from universities helping to collect the data. And we're in the second year of a three-year field season this summer. That is a very expensive study, but it's not specific to just aquaculture. So I can't really tell you. I think Mr. Johannes might have a better idea of, just as we're reviewing the license applications and doing our assessments and issuing the licenses, whether or not those fees are covering our costs. So I would defer to him on that.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, we've looked at raising commercial fees in 1987 and 2003, and basically we're at a point where we're not recovering our costs for administering, monitoring, and evaluating the license of all the commercial licenses that we issue.
Thank you. Let's follow up. The study that was done in 2003, and it was a very complete study, and I saw 17 recommendations in there. One that caught my eye of the recommendation of that study group at that time was that they say specifically there should be additional research conducted by a neutral entity. And I understand this is politically a tough issue because we have the Ag Department that would like to have people farm fish, and we have the duck department, which is all of us who would like to see ducks or hunt ducks and would like to see them succeed and be healthy enough to raise baby ducks. I mean, that's our goal here, one of my goals, anyway. And they recommended that we have research done by a neutral entity concerning the impact of fish on wetland ecology and quality. Important species include walleye, white sucker, which is one of our largest groups that we export fish. I mean, people in Arkansas, Nebraska, they'd like to have minnows, so we raise a lot of these minnows and we export them. So it's not only just to please our fishing people in Minnesota. This is an export business. And also muskie, northern pike, and black bullhead. Now, we know that some of those species actually do harm wetlands, especially the suckers, because they eat the invertebrates. The great invertebrate eater, which is what the ducks do, especially the baby ducks. Have we given any thought to that 2003 recommendation to have a neutral entity conduct research?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, actually the study that I was describing, the graduate students are under the direction of Dr. Kyle Zimmer from the University of St. Thomas, and he is an expert on wetlands and invertebrates and actually was a graduate student at one time himself on one of our earlier studies. So there is a university connection to the research that's being done. It's being done on this landscape level issue of where these wetlands are in the landscape, whether they're discharging water, receiving water, what sorts of chemical composition, all that sort of thing. They are not specifically addressing the white sucker issue, which is another question mark that we do think needs research, and we don't have anything currently ongoing on that.
Representative Calder.
is, have we ever, given the facts that we know in state law, current state law, that an applicant for a fish farming license, you could call it aquaculture, right? It's easier to say fish farming, that they cannot be a detriment to the wetland. Have we ever denied a license application? I understand they're good for 5 years, and then they have to be renewed after that. But have we ever denied a license, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, yes, we have several scenarios where we have denied licensing, and a number of them relate to what's called WPAs or wetland production areas. We've also denied applications for waterfall management areas. We've also denied licenses when there's a connection to other public waters. We have especially denied licenses if public fish and private fish have become commingled. So yes, we have. The examples are not a lot, more in the less than 10, but over 5 instances where that's taken place.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the basis for denial of those licenses, I can understand if they're connected to private waters or, you know, some way for the fish to get from one area to another, which is not good. We understand that. Have we ever denied them for being a detriment to the wetlands in their fish farming operations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, no.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in, and the bill is page 7, line 7.28, and it was amended by the A2 amendment regarding the parent or guardian having physical or verbal control over the person that's under the age of 16. Physical, I assume, means within essentially reach. That's the way I interpret it. And then the verbal control, I would assume that that would mean within, like, we are in verbal contact with each other. I don't agree with any of this. It's way too restrictive. But the question I have for, I think it would be Colonel Hamm, would be, would verbal control mean by radio? Let's say that we had these little walkie-talkies, you know, you can buy at Cabela's or Gander Mountain or Holiday. And, you know, I'd be sitting in my house and my kid's out on my farm bird hunting, and, you know, he says, Breaker 19, Dad, I got a bird in sight. You know, can I shoot? I mean, is that, I'm trying to get to the bottom of that, what that means, verbal control.
Representative McNamara, didn't we change that back to current language, or am I wrong with the amendment? Can you clarify that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, and we can have Colonel Hamm clarify this, but I think there was a mistake. As many of you know, I tend to talk too fast sometimes. I think the word visual and physical got transposed. My intent was, and the Colonel probably can address this, my intent was that either you'd be able to see, I use the example of deer hunting on the other side of a field, your son or daughter would be over there, you could see them, you could create a system of hand signals that would work to communicate, or you would be in verbal over the ridge or a few corn rows away in the sake of pheasant hunting. That was my intent, Representative Dill. Under current law, I think some conservation officers could have determined that you needed to be sitting in the same tree, deer hunting, and or in the same row in the cornfield. And maybe Colonel Hamm could add to that.
Mr. Hamm.
Mr. Chair and members, Colonel Mike Hamm, Chief Conservation Officer for the Department of Natural Resources. What we're trying to get at, Mr. Chair and members, is right now, from time to time, we have parents that are dropping their youth off, that the parents are supposed to be staying with the youth, and they're not. They're dropping them off, leaving them in the stand to be alone. Directly to the question, Representative Dill, about the use of radios, we would not be able to use the use of radios for the intent that you were talking about, because you can't use those for hunting protected species. So in other words, if your son or daughter was to ask the question, I'm chasing a rooster pheasant here, it's going to flush pretty quick, should I shoot it, or should I shoot it on the ground or something like that, that's That's not what the purpose of being able to use a radio controller or cell phone or something like that for. But what we're trying to get to is we've got children that are out there that are not being accompanied in any way, shape, or form. They're being dropped off, go to the deer stand, and I'll come and pick you up a few hours later, maybe after school, pick you up a half hour after sunset or something like that, and they're not staying out there with them. So to get to the accompanying part, we certainly want to have the young hunter to enjoy the great outdoors, and so being visual or the ability of the vocal piece, we feel is close enough contact. And if that's a distance, I mean, if we're out there checking somebody, we're checking your son or checking your daughter and say, where's the parent or the guardian, where's the uncle, where are mom and dad, and they holler out, hey, dad, the game warden's here, and the parent says, I'll be right over, that's what we're looking for.
What's on a deal?
Well, you wouldn't want to come up to St. Louis County and with a whole flock of game wardens, because you'd have half the Orr school locked up. And you have half the parents in jail, too. Hell, the kids get in the boat and go up 25 miles up the lake with their guns and at 5 o'clock in the morning in the dark and their decoys, and they hunt, and then they get on the bus and go to school, and the parents are at KGM pushing dirt, making a living. Well, I tell you, we're getting awful prescriptive. I just can't see. The people that live out in rural Minnesota don't live by this stuff. They just don't. But that's
why you want to delete that language out of the bill?
I absolutely would like to delete that language out of the bill.
Everybody understand the amendment?
Which amendment?
Representative Corn?
Can we go back to then accompanying?
Yes.
It's my understanding that this is actually loosening it, that accompanying could mean, besides, and they did this to loosen it up. You're actually going to tighten it up by your amendment, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman...
You've got to have them there. I mean, that's firearm safety. There's about firearm safety instructors, thousands of them in the state, going to go nuts right now if they could hear this conversation, because they teach the kids, you've got to be with the parent and under control. I live in rural farm country, too, and we don't let our kids go up, you know, that age.
Well, Representative Cornish, is this simply, and maybe Colonel Hamm can explain this, too, this is simply just defining what accompanied means.
Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, Mr.
Chairman, Bill?
Well, I mean, I don't think that accompanied, I mean, if I take my son to my 100 acres and he's out there in the deer stand and I'm in another deer stand and I can't yell at him, that's 100 acres is pretty much a quarter mile at least away. I can't yell at him and I can't see him because there's enough trees between us, and I can't yell at him loud enough over the wind or some other things if that's not accompanied. I mean, I've taken him to that location. I've instructed him probably where he's going to be when I'm coming to pick him up or when he's coming to pick me up, most likely. And I just think it's we're just going too far. I mean, and I tell you, in practicality, regardless of what the language is, in practicality, it's you may be with every kid down there pheasant hunting down in your county, but it's just not practical. And I would like to see the language change. Just stay with the original language. No change. We have, and but further, Mr. Chairman, we have the same kind of language about snowmobile use. I mean, it says the parents must be accompanied by, you know, youthful operators of snowmobiles. And, I mean, you know, when they're 15 years old, they can get a farm license and drive to town and pick up feed in an automobile unaccompanied. Now, they went to hunter safety and got a hunter safety certificate and learned how to use the firearm, what the proper protocol is. I'm just thinking we're getting too tight on this. And, I mean, I'm... It's just my thoughts on it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Helen, you understand the amendment? You have the amendment? What Representative Dill is trying to do?
Representative Dill wants to go back, as I understand it, to the original language in the statute, which is Section 15 without the stricken part and without the new language.
Correct.
Very good. Colonel Hamm?
Mr. Chair and members, the rest of the bill talks about the fact that if it is, or the actual current law, not the rest of the bill, the actual current law, what we're dealing with here is if the hunter is on land owned by or occupied as the principal residence of the person, or the person's parent or guardian, and also if the person is age 14 or 15 and has a firearm safety certificate. So if you are doing what Representative Dill says to a 14 or 15 year old that has a firearm safety certificate, they can be out there. You can be the 25 mile distance. We're dealing with that, the component that doesn't need to have the firearm safety certificate if they're out there hunting the pheasant, and they do have to be with a parent or a guardian anyway. That's what we're dealing with and trying to clear up. So Representative Cornish is correct by saying that going back to the other language is leaving it open for the conservation officer's interpretation, whereas by making this change, they have to be accompanied anyway. By making this change, it's easier for the parent, for the child, and for the officer to understand it's either visual or it's vocal.
Representative Dill, understanding that explanation, do you still want to make that change or want to withdraw your motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm going to do is I'm going to withdraw the motion and take a little more time to study and talk to the deer hunting lobbyists.
Yeah, and members, we're not voting on this bill today.
Right.
We're not voting the bill today, so we can clarify some of these things and come back next week when we wrap up the bill.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, I'll have a whole new amendment that will straighten this whole thing out and let parents be responsible and let kids learn how to be responsible.
Very good. Two issue. Representative Cox,
thank you, Mr.
Are you okay
Chair.
Now? Or?
Yeah, he answered it. Thank you.
Representative Hansen?
Yes, on this issue, Mr. Chair, how does this affect the decision we made last year regarding turkey licenses? Is this does this affect them or does not?
Mr. Chair and members, this doesn't affect that particular section of law.
Okay, where are we at now?
Mr. Chair, I think that was the finish of the explanation of the
A2. The amendment?
I believe we have an A6, Mr. Chair, that's your amendment. It was my understanding that we might move that one next.
I'm pretty soon they're going to have to have their kids.
Okay. Members, the A6 amendment. This issue has to do with... I'm going to be quite upfront and honest about this issue. I brought this language forward because on the Senate side, they want to put scopes on muzzleloaders, and I am not in favor of putting scopes on muzzleloaders during a muzzleloader special season. I don't care if people have scopes on muzzleloaders if they want to hunt deer during the regular deer hunting season. But for a special muzzleloader season that we have in the state of Minnesota, I don't believe that it was intended to put scopes on muzzleloaders. It was originally intended to be the old-fashioned flintlock style, I don't know what you want to call them, the old-style rifles. And I have this language, and I'm going to have an amendment to the amendment, members, on the A6 amendment. On line 13, a muzzle-loading firearm, and after the word firearm, insert, used in a muzzle-loader-only season, established, and then go back under clause 2, is a firearm equipped only with a flint, percussion cap, or musket cap. And members, I'd like to put this in the bill to take this to conference committee to argue the scopes on muzzleloader issue. I need some leverage over there, and I think Senator Saxhog knows that. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you and I have talked about this amendment, and I support it. I think it's important. The muzzleloader season was intended to be for muzzleloaders, and we've now got the technology out there where they basically become a single-shot rifle, and really the only disadvantage is now you still at least have the old-fashioned iron sights, and being one who hunted that for the first time this year, if we go to scopes, we must just extend the regular season and another 3 weekends, and I don't think that's prudent management. So I support the amendment.
Mr. Keller, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Two quick comments. Well, three, actually. Certainly, Mr. Chair, I understand your concern about the Senate amendments. Last year, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association were neutral on scopes on muzzleloaders. We were indifferent whether the legislature allowed them or did not allow them. This year, we've changed our position and support scopes on muzzleloaders, primarily because on my corporate board, we have some gentlemen who are wearing bifocals and trifocals, and they have trouble lining up the front sight and the rear sight. That being said, it's been my experience representing the Deer Hunters Association for over 10 years that any time you fiddle around with the archery season or the muzzleloader season, the phone calls and letters coming to the state capitol start flowing from all sorts of opinions. So I'll just sort of leave it at that, knowing your concerns about the scopes on muzzleloaders and the such.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keller, did I understand you correctly that they're having trouble lining up the front and rear sights, and that's the reason they want to have the scopes on there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, mm-hmm. Yes, that was the predominant rationale that I heard at our corporate board meeting on March 4th.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They realize they can hunt with scopes in the other season, though.
Mr. Sorry. Chair, Representative Cox, yes, they do realize that. However, the expanded muzzleloader season and allowing people to use these inline, more technologically new weaponry has encouraged a lot more people to hunt in the muzzleloader season, extending the times that people can go hunt. So I think certainly what Representative Hackbarth is doing with just this amendment without the scopes on muzzleloader concern would start to limit the numbers of people that would be hunting in that third season, the muzzleloader season.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Any further discussion? Representative McNamara?
Thank you.
It's a good amendment, Mr. Chair. I'm one who hunts with a scope on his deer rifle for 3 weekends during the regular season and got to hunt for 3 more weekends this year with iron sights, and my vision is going down, and that's the way it is. It's a different experience. That's the way it was meant to be originally, and I think it should continue to be that way.
Absolutely. I would incorporate those changes into my amendment and move the A6 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Okay, what do we like next?
Mr. Chair, I think we have a A4 amendment. I believe it's Representative Wagenius' amendment.
Okay, Representative Wagenius moves the A4 amendment.
Oh, there it is.
Representative Wagenius.
When I talked to you about the ducks, I talked to you about two major issues. One was the current law and enforcing the current law, and the second was making sure that DNR has permission from every riparian owner before a fish license can be issued. And that's simply what this does. It's, of course, the person who's requesting the license who is the one asking and making sure that gets the permission. It's not the responsibility of the DNR to go around and get everybody's permission. But if I want to get a license because I am one riparian owner on this body of water, I have to go around and get permission from these folks, and then I give that to DNR before DNR can issue the license. That's it, and I would move it. It's essentially a property rights issue.
Representative Cox.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius, if you have, 6 or 8 landowners and one of them doesn't agree with that, then that would hold up the issuing of the license?
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius, I think we've had this last year. Was this an amendment or a bill that you had at that time, too? I've seen this before.
You have seen it before, Mr. Chair. This was part of a bill I had. This is one small part of the bill, and the language is taken from there. I think there are real issues with riparian ownership rights. DNR sometimes requires permission. Say if you're going to do a shallow lake, they have to get they have to get permission from everybody. If you're going to aerate your wetland, you have to get permission from everybody. If you're going to put a whatever you put in to kill fish, you have to get permission from everybody.
So this is, I think, making it real clear and probably making life easier for DNR from my point of view, that everybody knows that DNR has to do this. I think they should be doing it now. I actually think under current law they need to, but it's not articulated in this particular section of law. It's articulated in general law, but not under this section of law.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In some respects, Representative Wagenius has brought up a really good point, and I wish I would have brought it up when she started to talk about it last year. I am almost jealous that here I am a duck hunter and she brought it up. But I think the reality is the DNR is into a significant study, and I'm nervous about us jumping the gun and not knowing what we're doing here. And if you want, we can bring somebody down from Fisheries or Mr. Bogus back. But I think the complications, I don't want to do stuff in the middle of the stream when we're not sure where we're at here. This is some serious stuff that I think we have to be dealing with, and I'd like to get the finish of that study back from the department and the professor at the University of St. Thomas, Mr. Chair, before we move forward.
I think that's what we've been talking about doing, and that's the direction we have to go. Anything further? Representative Spalding.
I was just wondering if in the study we will be getting legal opinions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Representative McNamara, will we be getting legal opinions in this study? Because it seems to me that we're going to be studying the condition of wetlands. I don't know that we're going to have lawyers telling us who's got property rights around that wetland.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scalzi, the gist of Representative Wagenius' amendment is just telling us that we have to go and get permission from every single property owner around this pond and get it in writing and get it to the DNR when they renew the license. It looks to me like it would take effect immediately. I don't know if these licenses are different days and stuff, but this may be telling them to be doing something immediately, and I don't know what the timing would be on all that happening. I just, members, this is a really, really important issue that we need to address, and I just would feel better having the background information. We have serious problems in some of our duck ponds with what's going on. At the same point, this is a big industry in our state, and we don't know everything. As Mr. Bogus said, some of these ponds are blue and some are brown, and we're not exactly sure why. And I'm just nervous of jumping the gun, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scalzi put her finger on one of the issues here. All the studies have to do with what's going on in the water. What we are talking about are water law basics as published by the Department of Natural Resources. This is from the Department of Natural Resources. And it said, riparian owners must exercise their rights reasonably so as not to interfere with the riparian rights of others. And this is DNR language. I'm not making this up out of any place else. This is what they say. This is the law they should be enforcing. I think it clarifies it. I think it helps them. And this is only for is it the right to come up for renewal. And this is just about property rights.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Helen, just looking at this amendment that meant that it talks about requesting and renewing. So is the effect of this amendment from this point on and not affecting the license that already exists?
Right. It would only affect a existing license when that license is renewed, whenever the renewal date is up.
Mr. Chair. And then Representative McNamara, in your bill, you have the moratorium on new licenses. Is that correct? So that if this amendment goes on, this would be affecting renewing licenses. It would be not, and would it be affecting? Wouldn't affect new licenses if there's a moratorium on, correct? But it would affect renewing licenses.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, there will be no new licenses. We're going to put a moratorium on licenses. There are certain bodies of water that aren't currently being utilized that still would be able to be utilized, but I think they're laid out in the license and ability currently. I want to make sure that's well known. When we adopt this moratorium, we are not using 100% of the available waters currently for the aquaculture. There are more waters available, but we're going to put a moratorium on any new ones. I think the new ones, they're not going to happen, so the permission deal wouldn't apply to where they can't happen. Mr. Chair and members, Deputy Commissioner Holson just also brought to my attention there's a possibility, because some of these could be public waters, it's unclear, we could be needing to get permission from the public. This is, I think, Mr. Chair, we just can't accept this amendment.
Representative Spaulding.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. The way I understood this, and I'm quickly going through it, that will restrict the use of water bodies that have not been licensed for private aquaculture or used by DNR for fish rearing in the past 5 years. In other words, if we have a wetland that somebody currently holds a license on and they're coming in for a renewal, this moratorium doesn't cover them. This is only for clear waters or unfished waters that haven't been fished ever again. So it looks to me like this would be a control group as we're studying the waters. But if we're talking about landowner rights and trying to get the landowners to sign on to it, that's altogether different from this, because there are current licenses that would be coming due, or a new license on a water that's currently being farmed for fish.
Well, Representative Scalzi, I think what we're talking about here is that the DNR is looking at this issue. Rather than jump the gun with some of these other bills and some of these other issues we're trying to talk about in the same category, let's wait until the DNR comes back and tells us what they found in the studies and the different, you know, what they're trying to do with this moratorium is to get at some of these issues and come back and give us some more information. We don't want to jump the gun and do something we might regret later. So I think that's where we need to go. Representative Scalzi.
Yes,
Representative Scalzi, we've got out of
the line. My question was, are we going to be consulting with legal counsel, or are we going to be studying the wetlands? That's why I asked the questions, because this is a legal issue. It's not a wetland study issue.
I understand. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, wondering if you would be amenable to taking out the renewal part and just kind of grandfather in the current ones, but new licenses,
Representative Westrom,
this would be applied. What's that?
We're not getting into that today. We're not going to get into that today. That's a whole other bag of worms.
Okay.
Representative Wiginius?
Yes, I would like to move this amendment.
Representative Wiginius moves the A4 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
Motion
does not prevail. Division being called for. All in favor of the amendment, raise their hand. Okay, all opposed to the amendment, raise your hand. There being a tie vote, the amendment is not adopted.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair, the next amendment,
we'd
like to move. I think Representative Cornish has got, I believe it's the A6, Representative Cornish.
Representative Cornish, the A9 amendment?
I might have said the wrong number, Mr. Chair.
A9. Representative Cornish.
Chair and members, real quickly here, I got
Cornish, I think the A9 is the deer tag one. I think yours was the shiny one. I might have said the wrong one.
Well, I got the A9, too.
Okay.
Okay, hold it.
Okay.
Which one? We're going to take the language from Representative Simpson's bill, 3395, and the chair will move the language contained in House File 3395 as an amendment to Representative McNamara's bill. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move to amend the language on that we just moved, House File 3395.
Okay.
And the amendment here, I believe I got an agreement with the presenter here and the author, and I'll do this with the understanding, if I misunderstood either one of them, that we'll take it back out, but that's what they told me. The change would be on the reverse side of that bill language, on line 2.1, strike the word raccoon, because it's going to be from January to March, and if they're not hibernating, they're in the breeding season. And the language on 2.6, add line 2.7, or however the council would do this, parentheses 5, and then put is using a shotgun. What this would do is restrict the use of firearms to shotguns so that we don't have the 3006 shooting into the dark with a spotlight. And those are the two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'm okay with the amendment.
I will incorporate your amendment into my amendment, Representative Cornish.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you,
let us know how you feel about the amendment. To the amendment.
Thank you. My name is Randy Duker, and I represent Minnesotans for Light Law Reform. We're the group that kind of spearheaded this the shiny movement and done a lot of work. We've got just a little bit of history and some of the concerns that came up as we talked to various individuals in the state. I'll run through it really quick. I know that you're real busy here. We started about a year ago trying to make the move to legalize artificial lights. We checked in with various states to see what they're doing, how we could do it different, the same, whatever worked. We talked to conservation officers. We talked to landowners. We collected 1,242 signatures, a petition that said that they wanted this. In April of 2005, I began working with the Department of Natural Resources, starting with the Fur Bearer Committee. Met with them, talked about some various issues, concerns. For example, bobcats. The population is healthy right now, but the concern was what the future might bring. So we made some compromises. We took bobcats out of the proposal. Following that fur bearer meeting, I learned that a conservation officer and his supervisor, Major Al Heidebrink, and conservation officer Brad Schultz were working on this very language. So I kind of teamed up with them. We went through all of the pros and the cons that we could come up with. We talked to a whole bunch of people to try to figure out what we could do. Some of the concerns, obviously, deer poaching. That's where the season came in, where we were anticipating running this from January 1st to March 15th. January 1st, all the deer seasons are over and done. March 15th, we chose that for an end date due to the closing of raccoon and fox season.
Mr. Buecher, how do you feel about the amendment to the amendment that Representative Cornish inserted in the bill? Do you support that?
Yes.
Very good. Nice to hear. All in favor of the House File 3395 as amended being inserted into the Game and Fish bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails.
No.
The bill is passed. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
You bet.
Okay, what do you want next?
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Cornish was going to present the A9 amendment.
Representative Cornish, A9.
Sir, I'd like to move the A9 amendment. What I've got here, Mr. Chair and members, is in a nutshell, I talked to the DNR Enforcement and the Deer Hunters Association. We have a preliminary agreement here on this language. And if anything does pop up that we can't see here between, because if you show it to a group of people on that side, this side, that side, five different hunters, they'll probably each come up with a different version. But this is the best we could do to accommodate the worry that somebody is dragging a deer or putting a deer in a cart and the tag tears off. Basically, what this change does is make it, whether you're dragging it from the site of the kill to the cabin or from the cabin out to the road, any time that you're dragging the deer, while it's being hand-carried, carted, or drug on the ground, you don't have to have the tag on the deer. You would have to if you were going to bring it into a place of overnight abode or a dwelling. It'd have to be attached. A validated tag would have to be attached. So after you shoot the animal, you validate your tag, but you don't have to put it on it while you're dragging it. So that's the content of this amendment.
Mr. Kelleher, how do you feel about the amendment as opposed to our House File 3355?
Mr. Chair, again, Tom Kelleher with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. As you know, we requested that you'd author House File 3355. We believe that Representative Cornish's amendment pretty much accomplishes the same thing. The DNR had some concerns about tag validations and things like that. I know that this bill's not leaving committee today, and this is sort of a work in progress. Colonel Hamm and I have been discussing some slight word modifications that we're not quite prepared to do today. One of our concerns, too, is that this would not impact party hunting. And I think some of the word changes that Colonel Hamm is considering would make sure that it did not affect party hunting, and we're going to talk about that before this bill leaves the committee. But this is a fine start, and we support the amendment.
Representative Cornish, do you want to proceed with the amendment? Do you want to wait till next week? Or?
Oh, I could just soon put it on with the agreement that if they have heartburn about the party hunting effect, that we'll work on it.
Very good. Any further discussion? Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say this is one of the most important parts of this bill because deer hunting up in Representative Dill's district where we do, and you're back in the woods 3/4 of a mile. To put the tag on and drag the deer out 3/4 of a mile, and you get out by the road and there's no tag left on it. You got to tag it at the site of kill. Just throw the tag in your pocket when you get out by the road. I mean, we had the presumption of everybody being guilty, and this is a big step forward, and I'm glad that Representative Cornish was able to work with us and get it done.
All in favor of the A9 amendments to signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails.
A9 is adopted.
Okay, next. Representative Hoppe.
That's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Which
thank
one?
You. A3.
Representative Hoppe moves the A3 amendment. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I did talk to the author. I believe he's agreeable to this, and the intent here is this would only pertain to muzzleloaders during the muzzleloader season. As my understanding, I'm not a muzzleloader hunter, that there is now technology out there and new kinds of powder that can be used in inline muzzle-loading rifles that allow them to shoot and essentially use smokeless powder. All we're trying to do is ensure, you know, muzzle-loading season was originally brought forward as more of a primitive firearms special season. They wanted to have their own time, and all this would do is ensure that the smoke pole hunters are generating smoke when they shoot.
I support you,
Representative McNamara. Any further discussion? All in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Got to get up there a little quicker, Kelleher. Let's see. Who's next?
I believe Representative Dennis.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have talked to the author about this, so it'll be quick.
Which
on
one?
Page 5. No.
Which?
Page 5 of the bill. 3116. I would like to amend that to take out, to restore the language that is crossed out, the up to 500, on the owner of a dog that kills or pursues a big game animal is guilty, blah, blah, blah.
Where are we?
Do you see where I am?
No.
Line 2.
Page 5. Am I totally out of it?
Oh, yeah. Line 2.
Yeah.
Line 2. And I can give you all the reasons for this, but let me just say I think that the CEOs still have the competence to decide if my dog takes after a deer going through the yard, if I need to pay $500 or $100 or shoot the dog.
Mr. Chair and members,
the
only reason that we ask for this is there isn't any statutory authority that is granting the officer to be able to come up with that dollar amount. Although the language states that there's not a process used, there isn't any rule process, there's not public input. It would be somebody is just imposing what they think, and that somebody would be the Division of Enforcement is imposing what they think. We actually have operated in the past with a dollar amount that was at the $300 range. We actually got rid of that directive and just went to the $500 range because the restitution for a big game animal is $500. And so whether an individual shoots it or whether a dog kills it, the animal is dead either way.
And that's why we are asking for direction from the legislature, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, this says if they kill or pursue, and I think you were referring to kills, but I don't know. And can we at least work on some language, since we're not passing this out today, to get it?
Can we do that, Colonel Ham?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I have to tell you, I do agree with Representative Pennis that we should do something in that regard.
Okay.
I have to tell you, I really do feel that way.
And, Mr. Chair, I will say we've had numerous lengthy discussions about this dollar amount already, and I know Representative Cornish is also interested in this.
Representative Pennis, I really think that we do need to work on that, and if you could work with Colonel Ham on that, I'd appreciate it, because I agree with you 100%.
Okay.
What's that? No. Representative Pennis withdraws her amendment at this time.
Yeah.
The A8 amendment. Is that mine? The chair moves the A8 amendment. This is, we had somebody just recently, and I don't know if Colonel Ham wants to talk to this issue or who does. This is a dark house issue where this is the one where you can spear and angle out of one house. And we had an issue where somebody was angling at night out of their dark house, which is fine, but you can't have a spear in the house when you're angling. And I don't think that's right. And I don't see what's wrong with spearing and angling at the same time anyway. So I bring forward this amendment. This is an amendment that's been brought forward by the Dark House Association. Representative Hopp.
Mr. Chair, quick question about this. Is it possible that, and I'm not saying that I've ever been a party to this, but somebody would be spearing and have a line in the water, catch a smaller fish, leave that fish on the line? Is that what we're after here?
Well, we've got in here that that cannot take place.
Okay.
Yeah. That says that in the amendment. That cannot take place. Any further discussion? Representative Hamm.
Mr. Chair, and members.
Hate to demote you like that.
I had staff and even I myself contacted what were game wardens back pre-1969. I talked to retired officers that started in the late 50s to ask for a brief history as to how come it's how come we do this, and the answer was because that's how it's always been done. I mean, it's been this way since the 50s. Having said that, the only concern in a variety of methods that officers could think of would be exactly what Representative Hoppe was talking about, where you would either hook a small crappie or a sunfish and leave it in there, which would attract then a larger northern. Or the other component would be is you might hook a northern on the end of the line, not necessarily good enough to be able to retrieve the fish, but good enough that when you throw the spear in and the splash of the water occurs, you kind of slow the fish down so that it can't get out. So in other words, you're probably going to increase the success rate, or you could increase the success rate of the spear. But as far as the history, it's. I wish I had something for you, but I don't.
Very good.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? All in favor of the A8 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, A8 is adopted. Yep. Members, we have some people that have came a long way that would like to speak to the bill, particularly on the second to the last portion of the bill, Section 28, and I think it has to do also with Representative Wagenius' issue. So if they can come forward at this time, Mike Holm, Philip and Steve, Section 26, I'm sorry. I say one thing and think something else. Welcome to the committee. Who's going to go first? Please state your name and who you represent for the record. And we're going to have to leave here in 15 minutes, so we got to wrap her up.
My name is Mike Holm. I'm with West Central Bait and Fisheries out of New London. I'm also the co-president of Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, I'd like to just state that this business of fish raising We've been in business, our company, since 1956. So I guess the one issue that, where did all the ducks go? Duck hunting was good back then. We haven't changed a lot of stuff that we're doing. We raise most of our fish, go to the state of Minnesota. We sell either the walleyes to the state of Minnesota. Our minnows go to, we have 25 bait shops that we provide bait to. We also supply about a half dozen wholesalers in the state of Minnesota for their routes. We employ 10 people in our company. And I guess a lot of these rulings, a lot of what's happened is out of our hands for the degrading of the wildlife. It's the tiling issue. I mean, it's the biggest thing we've seen, water. It has to do with the tiling. It has to do with the state coming in from MnDOT, putting all of a sudden a lower culvert. Now there's fish in another body of water that never had them. I'll pass it on from there.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Steve Puchtel. I own McKenzie Fish. I'm from North Branch, Minnesota. I'm the past president of Minnesota Aquaculture Association. And I'm also a past member of the Minnesota Pheasant Waterfowl Society, board member. One of the things that I see, all the fish farmers and the state of Minnesota, all the water that we have licensed for fish farming is 70,000 acres of water. It sounds like an immense amount, but in all reality, we have 10.6 million acres of water in the state of Minnesota, not counting Lake Superior, which is 10% of all fresh water in the world. That 70,000 acres represents only 3/4 of 1% of the water in the state of Minnesota. If our 3/4 of 1% is affecting ducks in this state, then we've got a big problem. I just don't see how that small amount of water that we have licensed is affecting it. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I'm a farmer also, and I raise ducks on my farms on the water that I live on. I'm not a hunter anymore. Other than that, I see the restrictions on us are very, very strict right now. We have a lot of criteria that we have to meet before we can license water. The DNR is in charge of us. We don't have a problem with that. We continue like that. And I think all of us would like to see why there's a problem with ducks. And we'd like to work with the ducks rather than against the duck people. And I hope we can get to that point. Thank you, for Chairman and committee members.
Very good. I agree with you 100%. Phil? Is it Kip? Cope? You guys stick around. We might have some questions for you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Phil Kep, Burbank Bait Company. It's on Battle Lake, Minnesota. We've been in business for 58 years. I believe I bought business from my dad in 1976. And the Sam Illstrip is the one that refers to me. That's the pond that I lease. And I've been leasing that pond since 1975. So we've been raising minnows in there for 40 years. So I don't know where he gets his stuff from. Erickson Pond, we call it. You said he has the right, but how about the farmer that I pay $350 to that owns 99% of the lake? Does he have rights? And when this pond was licensed, Illstrip's land never run up to the lake due to the high water. Now he has 200 feet of lakeshore. So we get that straight. When it was licensed, he never owned land on the lake. He said the water's dirty. Since the last 2 years, somebody threw bullheads in there, which we don't want. I don't know who did it, but that's probably why the lake is dirty, because now there's bullheads in there. Yeah, I guess somebody was asking what we pay for fishing license, my license. With the sucker eggs I buy this year, I paid the DNR $6,300. So that's what it cost me. Anybody have any questions?
Representative Wagenius.
I'm curious if you are one of our bigger fish farmers, and if so, are you one of our smaller ones?
Probably one of the bigger ones. My father started it 58 years ago, and that's the reason we do have 4,000 acres of water. But out of that 4,000 acres, I'm probably only using half of it, because the other half I do have license, but people build, stuff seem to get into them. I'm kind of waiting for a rough winter. They're only 8, 10 feet. They will freeze out, but right now they got game fish in them. Bullheads, gluten, nothing edible, but so we need a bad winter to kill this stuff off.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was my only question.
Okay. Mr. Kemp, where did you say you were from? Burbank?
Burbank is where it originated. We live off the address is Crithrell now. My kids go to Battle Lake High School. Okay. Between Fergus Falls and Alexandria.
Were the Kramers in business up there in the bait business?
Yeah, Lee Ryan. Yes, they're actually my cousin's uncle.
Really?
Yes.
Joe Kramer is a very, very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
Representative Cornish.
What relation to Marv?
he's my younger brother.
What's that?
He's my younger brother. No, he's older than I am. Yep. I'm his brother, yeah.
Okay, he's the one that got the one in Nisqually.
Yes. Yeah, he's older. So he's got his finder,
yeah. Right. What, how many businesses do you guys have?
Well, we probably take care of 75 shops and probably like 50 wholesalers. And I would say 75% of the bait stays in Minnesota, you know. And we do haul some out of state to Wisconsin. And a lot of it, actually, we sell to DNR in Wisconsin for fish food and for raising the walleyes. It's all in bids. A lot of the crappie minnows we get that grow naturally in these ponds, we don't put them in there. We just take them out. A lot of them go to the DNR in Wisconsin.
Representative Hansen?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the witness and the other two folks. It appears we've had some history here. 2001, a study. 2003, a study. Last year when we debated this on the floor, we heard we needed more time to look at the issue. We're back here in 2006, and we're hearing we need more time, and Representative McNamara has in his bill
We knew that the DNR was coming forward with this plan.
Ask him a question that...
I just want to let you know that last year when this was on the floor, we knew that the DNR was coming forward with this moratorium language.
Right. And my question is that if this is 2007, are you willing to work with the various folks in these task forces to come to a compromise where it may need more restrictions on your business or... I mean, that's my question, and I have that for the other two folks as well.
Mr. Kemp?
Would you rephrase that again?
Representative
Well, we've had approximately 4 years of, 3 to 4 years of study on this. We have another year of a moratorium. Is that enough time at the end of 2007? Are you prepared to come to a compromise with folks who may disagree with you that may result in restrictions on your business?
Well, I hope not, but I think it would give us enough time.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Rob Jost. I represent the Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers Association. I'm from Alexandria. And getting back to blaming us aquaculture people for the duck problems. Typically, the good duck marshes are ponds that we don't raise fish in. They're totally different. The ducks are in the 6-inch to 3-foot deep ponds that have high fertility, lots of weeds, and we don't typically raise fish in those. To blame us for the depletion of the duck population, it just seems very unfair. I'm a duck hunter, and I'd like to see the duck population up again. And I don't know why it's down, but there's probably many, many reasons. And to pick us out of a crowd and go after us, I just think it's somewhat unfair. And I guess that's probably.
That's Falsey.
Oh, I forgot my question. That was so interesting. And I do buy bait from the Kep family in Nisqually. That's a great bait shop. The question that I'm kind of concerned. You have lots of ponds and wetlands that you farm. How much do you export? What percentage of your business is an export to out of Minnesota?
I would say 25% of my bait goes out of state, 75 stays in. And I just would have to say, I think last year, I don't have numbers, but it's probably around 70 lakes I rent, and last year I paid $40,000 pond rent to these farmers. So, we don't get in there for nothing. We pay for what we get to.
Okay, folks, we're going to have to wrap up here very, very soon. We've got to get, I think we've got caucus and we've got session at 3 o'clock. So, Representative Wiggins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it perhaps is blame is the wrong word. I think it's just recognizing the science that's coming forth and saying that where there are more fish, there are less invertebrates, and there are less stuff. And there are big studies that show this. So we have gotten to the point of understanding that the intensity of the fish farming is a problem. And I can see maybe 40 years ago when there was less intensity, and there certainly was less intensity, and there was less acreage under fish farming in the wetlands, we weren't seeing the dust problem. We weren't seeing it in 1970. Now we're seeing it. And science has drawn a direct relationship. So we do have to find that way that we can all live and work together so that the Duff folks are happy and you guys are happy. But we do have to look at the new science and the sound science that come forward and say, you know, gotta worry about the fish food. I mean, the duck food.
Yes. Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Mr. Ketz for coming down here today. He happens to be in business in my legislative district. And, again, thank you. And I just wanted to ask, how many employees do you have?
I have seven full-time employees.
Okay. Thank you.
I think in 1970, when Dad had it in Urbank, he had a population of 90 people, and he had 25 employees. So the bait business has gotten smaller. You know, it has, you know.
Anything further? Members, we're going to lay House File 3116 over for further consideration. We may be bringing it up on Tuesday. We're trying to work out our schedule at this time. It may be Wednesday. It may be Thursday. I'm not sure at this time. But we're going to be bringing it back up so we can get it to the Environment Finance Committee and so we can meet all the deadlines. But there's a couple other issues out there that we're looking at. And hopefully we can get it all wrapped up next week. So members, with that, meeting adjourned.